Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, hello, this is Andy Kirkpatrick out on the roads, the byways, and the is it a Boleyn? There's an Irish name for little tiny roads. Boleyn. The Boleyns anyway. So I'm out, it's very dark, there's no street lights here, so I've got my Hi-Vis on, got my Petzl head touch on, and I'm pushing a pram with yet another baby in it. Christ almighty. So it was about 2 years ago, I think, when I did a podcast where I was probably pushing another baby up this very same dark and lonely road. So this is baby number four. So I've now got two full sets of kids. That's cool. So this one's called Isla. As I mentioned, I think on the last podcast, all my children have four letter, two syllable names. So it's Ella, Ewan, Noah, Isla. I think people have like one syllable names are usually a bit thick. People with three syllable names are usually a bit posh. So two syllable names, it's kind of hedging your bets. You can always shorten it as well. That's a good thing. So it could be like L or No or U or Isle. So Ella was telling me not that I shouldn't call Noah, because it's like Noah Kirkpatrick. He'd be like, no, okay, no. So I don't know. It's very hard thinking up children's names. So yeah. So anyway, so this is Isla, who is now 4 weeks old. It's kind of weird. I'm actually going to talk. This evening, if the baby doesn't wake up, I'm going to talk about some sort of winter climbing kind of stuff. So there will be some climbing related stuff in this podcast. I know it's hard to believe, but it's really cold. So it's not really cold, but it's cold for around these parts. So, but anyway, quick catch up since the last podcast. So yeah, so this baby arrived. It's kind of when you have a baby, when a baby's coming, it's kind of sort of terrifying. Like I always tell people, like having a baby it's a bit like having like a terminal illness. Like there's there's never a good time, and really it shouldn't really be, you know, your choice. I don't think either. I don't believe all this kind of contraception stuff and all that kind of malarkey. So I think I posted something about how you know, like populations were declining and the sperm count had like halved or something since the 1960s or something. Someone commented like, "Oh, you don't have that problem anyway." I know. Anyway, so I do. You have to practice at it, don't you? Anyway, so Isla came along. So it was kind of, you always know that baby's always going to come in the night time for some reason. There must be a reason. I don't know why. Because that's when all the animals must be out. All the dangerous animals, I'd have thought. Or maybe not. I don't know. So yeah. So like, it's like every night when the baby doesn't come, you kind of like, when you wake up in the morning, it's probably like, again, it's probably like dying. You know, you've got some sort of terminal illness and you think you're going to die. But every night, every morning you wake up and you're not dead. It's like, oh, that's nice. And yeah, so it's a bit like that with a baby. But you know you're going to die and you know baby's going to come. So it's just, you know, you're not really enjoying it that much, you know, because you know it's going to happen. Anyway, so eventually I think Vanessa, who she was when I had the baby, Vanessa was, she said, oh, I feel a bit weird. This is about like 5 o'clock. And I was like, oh God, don't milk it, woman. And so she said, I feel about like her waters hadn't broken or anything. So I was like, put tea on, you know. I'm not going to hospital without having my tea. Anyway, so I think I cooked anyway. And then maybe she actually cooked for some reason. And her brother was staying with us, just in case, ready for action. Anyway, so she was cooking the tea. And she also made some cheese twists. So quite good things to make for if you've got kids. Made some cheese twists and then took Nora upstairs, got him in the bath, you know, read him his stories, got his pyjamas on. And we always have this ritual where I always have to go upstairs and say good night to him. Anyway, so when I went upstairs to say good night, Vanessa just didn't look very happy. She looked like she was in some discomfort. So I was like, okay, good night, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. Anyway, so she got him to bed and she's like, oh God, I've definitely got contractions. Like, I think it's when your contractions are every 5 minutes, 5 minutes apart, you're supposed to go to hospital, I seem to remember. Anyway, she was like, oh God, the baby's coming. Baby's coming. So it's like, don't panic, quick, put some water on, you know, boil some towels or something. Anyway, so then she's like, no, we need to go to the hospital, we need to go right now. So her brother's like trying to be all cool and calm and collected. Anyway, so we're like, you know, we'll give you a ring, tell you what's happening, because he has to suddenly look after this 2-year-old, and he's, you know, he's a barrister, you know, well, you know, it's not good. Anyway, so we get in the car, and I'm trying to drive, you know, on speed limit and try to be cool. But her waters were like two minutes and 15 seconds. Her contractions. I kept calling it the contraptions for some reason. Anyway, contractions. So it was pretty, oh, this bloody yappy dog. Anyway, this dog like wakes up. This dog wakes up, this baby, I'm going to be furious. There's actually two points on this circuit where like both this baby and Noah always wake up at the same time. I don't know if it's haunted, but it's exactly the same point. Like it must be like some sort of electricity pylon or something. There's a place up here where someone was, a priest was killed during the Civil War. Maybe it's a ghost, I don't really know. Anyway, yeah, so we managed to get to the hospital. Baby hasn't come, but it's kind of get out of the car. It's a bit of a take ten paces, and you have to, she had to like stop and let the pain subside. Have you ever wanted to have a shit really badly and you left it too late? I reckon it must be like that. It's like, oh my god, you know. So anyway, so we get to this hospital, and it's like an island. They have a weird system. It's like a shit version of the NHS, which is shit anyway. It's like shit. It's a shit. It's like a. I used to have this waterproof jacket that wasn't. It wasn't breathable, but it wasn't waterproof either. Like the health system in Ireland's a bit like that. Like it's worse than the NHS, but we have to pay for it. It's that kind of deal anyway. So everything was closed up, and there's like some cleaner going. Like, you know, go around the back. Anyway, so you have to go around the back and find this bloody door where there's no, you know, there's no way of knowing how to, there's bells everywhere, you're pressing all these buttons. Like, let me in, my wife's having a baby. Anyway, so eventually some nurse wanders up and like, walking into the hospital. She lets us in. No signage whatsoever to find out. You just need a massive sign going, having a baby, go this way. Having a heart attack, go this way. So, if there's nothing really wrong with you, turn around. So anyway, so we're just wandering around in the wrong place. Eventually, get in, and she's like, they're like, oh, how far are your contractions? She's like, about 2 minutes now. And they're like, all right, okay, well, come and sit down. So we get into this room, and a waters break, like in the room. So it's like, there's like water everywhere, and everyone's like slipping in their Crocs and stuff. It was like very funny. It wasn't funny for Vanessa, because by now she was too late to have any, you know, put her on a TENS machine or have any kind of like pain relief. Basically, the baby was coming, so yeah. I don't know if you've ever been to a birth, but it's probably one of the most terrifying experiences. Like, it wouldn't be more terrifying if it was you having the baby, but there's this person you love with this thing inside them trying to get out that you also, I guess you do, you love it. I don't know, you definitely don't want it to die. You know, you've almost put down like a down payment that you're going to love it. you know what it's going to mean. So, you know, it's just like, you really are on a knife edge if this baby kind of lives or die. You know, probably not less so these days, because the doctor can rush in and do his stuff. But yeah, really, really, really terrifying. You'll feel like you're gonna cry, and oh god, it's like, you know, what do you do? Anyway, by now Vanessa was like, you know, give me something, give me anything, like cut it out of me and all this kind of stuff. And you know, it's like, ooh, and I do it all, oh god. You know, like, you know, I know you even watch people doing like weightlifting, you're always like tensing when they're doing it. It's a bit like that when you're just like, come on, push. And it was kind of weird. You suddenly get to this, you can see probably more so when someone doesn't have any pain relief, because really, once you start having like pain relief, you start losing your ability to do what's necessary, really. You know, you really need to be fully in control of your body. Anyway, but eventually you just sort of could see that Vanessa went into this kind of space, you know, in this, like, into a place where the pain didn't really you know, it was, you know, it didn't really mean anything. And the midwife's like, come on, it's going to be out in the next 5 minutes. And, you know, it's like, really? There's really surreal bits where, like, oh, the head's poking out, like you can feel the head. It's like, oh, I'm all right, thanks. And anyway, all of a sudden this baby like plops out. And when a baby comes out, it basically looks like it's dead. It looks like it's this kind of like grey, misshapen, squished sort of thing, really. And I think the first time you see a baby, you think it must have died. It's like really horrible. And then slowly it starts kind of coming to life and starts, starts turning sort of white, and then it starts turning pink, and then suddenly it starts crying, and it kind of, it's amazing how it kind of basically like latches on, so like that's breastfeeding, like almost like immediately. It's an absolute marvel. Anyway, so all this took less than an hour for the baby to come, which is, God, the baby's awake. Come on, go back to sleep. Shh. So I think the baby must think I'm talking to it. It's also about like 1 degree. So it's quite cold. It's good for your skin though. I met some old guy out here. That the Currans were like a family, and they had 16 kids. So the mother had 16 children, 12 boys and 4 girls. Go back to sleep. I think I have to finish this podcast. Sorry. I'm going to go into radio silence. Right, back again on the podcast. I probably recorded the first part of that podcast, of this podcast, about, I think it was 2 months ago. So there's been a bit of a gap. I did try to carry on earlier on, but I had a cold, so I did the podcast and it sounded terrible. So anyway, so I'm back again. Sorry for the long delay. I was out this morning actually pushing the pram, and the weather was so bad. I put like a 20 kilo plate, like from weightlifting plate, into the buggy, so the buggy wouldn't fly away in the wind. It was so bad. Like sometimes I'm laid in bed in the night, and the weather's so bad. It's almost like a joke. It's like you've got to be joking. Like this is insane. Like the rain, like just being crazy. So I've been going around for a last month. I bought one of those picky up things. So I've been going around. I've been like picking up litter as I've been pushing this pram around. I'm basically doing probably doing 3 to 4 hours a day pushing this pram around, which is kind of getting in the way of doing anything else. And so I've been picking up bottles and picking up. I've probably mentioned this in other podcasts, but the last time I did this was like, it's probably 2 years ago, well, a year and a bit ago. Is you go around and you start getting the big things, like the big bottles and the cans out of hedgerows, and then you end up picking up, you know, get smaller and smaller and smaller, and then you start having to like seek it out and like go into bushes and find the rubbish and stuff. And this is basically like a 10 kilometer kind of circuit, so there's quite a lot of room. And then you get smaller and smaller and smaller till you're picking up like, you know, like bits of litter. Like, you know, I was always intrigued when you saw people like litter picking, like for their job, and how they'd be like picking up the most tiniest thing, like a, you know, a cigarette butt or something. But it is, it's kind of interesting. But I've been told I can't do it for a while because
I've basically collected so much rubbish that I've picked up a whole thing of like a whole wheelie bin full of rubbish, and we haven't got any room for our rubbish now. But then today, because the weather was so bad when I got home today, the bin had blown over and all the fucking rubbish had gone everywhere in our garden. So I was like cursing. It's like, fucking, I hate you, God. You know, anyway, it must be some kind of test. You know, it's like, anyway. So, yeah, have I got any news? Yeah, the child is still with us and everything else. That's good. So I should. Oh, can you hear the wind? I should carry on. I wanted to have a shout out. It's probably late now because it probably was a good shout out like a month ago, to Dave McLeod, because. Dave McLeod is, a month ago, he sort of went down this rabbit hole where he was talking about eating beef. Like, I don't know if he follows Dave McLeod, but I would highly recommend following Dave McLeod because he's got some, he's basically going down the eating meat thing. Because Dave did a degree in sports science, and now he's done a degree in a master's in sports nutrition or something. And so he's really completely gone into the eating meat kind of thing. And so that's kind of now him, he's become adjacent to the, you know, like, you know, cows are destroying the planet kind of thing. So he's, but he's been kind of brave. Like, it's basically all based on data. Like, if you base things on data, then you're generally, you know, ideally you should be okay, but but it doesn't really apply in this day and age. Like, if you got if you can show that the temperature of the earth hasn't increased for 8 years or something, that's just not, you know, you're obviously, like Dave's obviously being paid by big meat or something, you know, it's like it's been quite brave. I'm sure he's like pissed off a load of people because it's, you know, climbers are the worst kind of people for believing all this stuff. Because most of them, like, live in a city. They think that, you know, they just don't know where anything comes from. So yeah, why can't we, you know, we need to just ban all fossil fuels and ban all meat and just live on, you know, I don't know what you're going to live on. But, you know, so Dave, you know, kudos to Dave. But I think it's one of those, things where you focus on one thing that you think, you know, like the people they're misled, basically. They're kind of fooled by things, you know, that the people they trust to tell them what they should think, you know, they're basically abusing the trust. So Dave's actually, you know, saying things that could really benefit people's health and everything else. But probably the biggest thing is going to benefit your health is just realizing, like, a lot of the stuff we think is just total bullshit. So well done to Dave. But what generally happens is when you start pulling on one thread, like, the whole thing basically starts pulling apart. So that's kind of a, you know, so it'd be interesting if Dave's going down that thing. I listened to this thing. It was about, for some reason, I was like a detransitioning period of listening to stuff. But there was someone talking about detransitioning. I had to turn it off. It was too distressing. But there was this Graham Lynham who wrote Father Ted and the IT Crowd and stuff. Like, he basically was like a normie person, and then he sort of got really against the whole like transitioning children kind of things. He basically has destroyed his life over it. Like, he's lost his marriage and he's got no work, and, you know, it's pretty depressing, you know, seeing, and a lot of the things he was, you know, upset about and was arguing against are now becoming sort of mainstreamed, really. There's a lot of people who are trying to transition kids who are now, you know, they're not allowed to do it because they've realized how bad it is, you know. You basically, your man, your Turin, and Alan Turin, you know, basically, you know, he was kind of being transitioned by the state by chemically castrating him, and a lot of the same things are kind of happening now to young people. But with the state, well, again, we're still with the state doing it. Anyway, so it's, but yeah, but even when you listen to Graham Lynham, it's interesting because you can hear that when he's talking, he's kind of compartmentalized his, what would you call it? Heterodox sort of thinking about one thing, but he's really, you know, he's very traditional in lots of other things. I'm not saying I'm someone who knows what the hell's going on, but it is a, yeah, you kind of, I suppose you're like on a, like, it's like a raft. You've got a raft of things that you're holding on to and you're trying to keep from drowning. You know, you've got these things that you think are buoyant and they're keeping you alive. But what you don't realize is like most of them are actually made out of like lead or something. And that's you can probably swim without them, you know, but you're holding on to them and they're dragging you down. So, you know, you've got what you've got is you think one of them, that's the one I need to get rid of, but really you probably need to get rid of all these things. So yeah. Anyway, don't know why I was saying that. I probably had a reason. Doesn't matter. So let's get down to some proper podcasty kind of things. So I had a few, because it was the winter time. It's coming up to winter. People are going winter climbing and stuff. I had a few questions to do with like winter climbing, and is the winter over now? I don't know. Probably, when is it? No, it's probably not over yet. So I thought I'd just do a quick rundown of some sort of thoughts on like wintery climbing-y kind of things, because my son's going to wake up in a minute. I'm going to have to go and get him. Do you know, having kids, it's a bit like I always tell people, it's like having a terminal illness. Is, you know, it's not something you should really, you know, think too much about. You just let it just happen, and then they're very similar two things. I thought I'll have a quick rundown of some random thoughts off my head that will just about winter climbing. But this is not, as usual, this is not scripted. This is just me sat here, thinking about them. So we'll start when you're going through. I'll talk about kit type stuff and also like technical kind of stuff. Like although I haven't actually touched any snow for a long time or any ice, probably since like 2019. I have in the past, I have done quite a lot of that kind of stuff, like alpine climbing, mixed climbing, ice climbing, all those climbing type things. So unlike rock climbing, which, you know, if you don't do it for like a week, you're shit. Ice climbing and mixed climbing, it's not really like that. So a lot of it is like technique, and a lot of it's in your head, really. So like climbing a grade 6 like ice route is probably like doing like a hard VS or something, and doing like a grade 8 route is probably like doing like an E3 or something, or E1. it's not like, if you don't do it, you can't do it ever. You know, you have to train up again to get to that level. So a lot of it is about you know, sort of not to do with like how strong and your stamina and stuff. So let's start with we'll work on like technical kit kind of stuff. So let's start with the head, like your head. So wear a helmet. That's good advice. Most people are going to be wearing a helmet. If you're doing like cascade kind of climbing, probably for winter climbing. I can hear a baby crying. That's a different baby. That's the one. I'm not in charge of that baby. So if you're doing technical kind of climbing, no, if you're doing any winter climbing, really you should get like a hard helmet. You always want a hard helmet in winter. So you want a helmet with a hard shell to it. You don't want a polystyrene thin shelled helmet that'll disintegrate. So you don't want a, what are they called now? Anyway, do you know what I mean? You don't want like a poly. You can have a one that's got a hard polycarbonate outer and then a polystyrene inner. But you don't want one that's got like a very, that's basically going to break apart the first time you get hit by a piece of ice or something. And the same applies that if you fall down a 1,000-meter gully and you've got like a polystyrene helmet, the first thing your head strikes is going to disintegrate your helmet. And then the second thing your head strikes is going to disintegrate your head. So a lot of climbers will have polystyrene style helmets because that's what you want for rock climbing. Like when your head hits something, when you're rock climbing, your head is more likely to hit something than something hit your head, probably. You know, when you fall, the rope's behind your leg, you whack your head, you know, whatever, you hit the ground, you whack your head. So, but for winter climbing, mountaineering, you really want like a hard helmet. And ideally you want a helmet that's a combination of like hard polycarbonate, plastic outer and polystyrene style inner, really. So you get the best of both worlds. So, you know, so if you can do a lot of it, wear two helmets. You know, if you're going to do a lot of rock climbing and winter climbing, mountaineering, then it is actually worth having two helmets. Make sure it's always worth having like, you know, you always want like the best head torch you can have. Don't get something super, super lightweight. You're like being able to see where you are is a massive advantage. So well, sometimes not having a head torch is probably better. No, but you want a good helmet. You've got a good head torch that gives you a lot of distance, lasts a long time, got batteries charged. And instead of carrying a second battery, the less and less ones now where you'd have a second battery, just carry a second head torch, like a smaller head torch that you can use when the other one's, you know, not working anymore or you've dropped it. Like, it's very easy to lose a head torch winter climbing, like the skin get knocked off by the snow or whatever. Always put your head torch on before it gets dark. That's good advice. Like, you know, some people would, like, you don't want to climb with it on your helmet for most things, because it just gets in the way of everything. It scratches on the rock and you can get slings and stuff caught on it. So, but always put it on, you know, if it's going to get dark at like 4:30, like, you know, if you're at 3:30, like, put it on so you don't, you know, because it's always going to get dark when you're right on the crux or something, or you can't, your rucksack's down below and you can't, it's very hard to build a belay in the dark in the winter, you know, to work out where to put your gear and stuff. So yeah, have your head torch on, make sure it's always charged up. What else? Goggles. Always have goggles, but don't put them, just save your goggles until you really, really need them. And you'll know when you need them because your eyes will be bleeding or something. So, keep your goggles protected, put them in something soft, and put them in something waterproof, and put them somewhere where they're not going to get broken. And when you put them on, put them on and don't take them off. So that's why the goggles are basically no good for a lot of climbing, especially not in the UK. If you haven't put your goggles on to get to the route, then probably don't go, because if it's that bad, then don't go, probably. You know, if you've got like a good hood on your jacket and good face protection, you should be able to get, you know, if the weather's not great, you should be able to get there without putting your goggles on. But when you're coming back down, you know, you're often coming out in really, really bad weather, and that's when you want your goggles on. So you basically clean all the snow off your face, any dampness on your face, try and dry around your eyes, and then whip your goggles on, but don't get any snow in them, don't get anything in them, put them on, put the strap around the back of your head, ideally put it on with everything off your head. So then once your goggles on, then you can put your hood up. Like, don't put it over the top of everything, because every time you want to take your hood off, you're going to have to expose your goggles. So and then just keep them on until you're down or something, because it's the taking them on and off that basically makes them not work anymore. They get snow in them and they steam up and everything else. And but they're the best option, but they're not ideal. Like, if you go in skiing, you know, if you're in skiing, you can put your goggles on first thing in the morning, and you could probably leave them on, apart from going in to have a cup of tea or something, you can leave them on all day and they work fine. But with winter climbing, you know, you often be really, really hot, sometimes really, really cold. They'll steam up. So it's, you know, they're tricky things to do, to deal with. What else on your face? When you're navigating or when you're route finding on a route, like it can be quite complicated. That's why head touch is really good. But sometimes turning your head touch off is the best thing as well. Like if it's dark and you're coming down, or you're going up in the dark, or you're on the route and you can't work out where to go, like sometimes just turning off your head touch for a few minutes and let your eyes be able to see. Because the thing, especially in winter, snow is very white and rock is generally black. So you can often see a lot better in the dark than you can see in the light. Like you might in the dark, if you turn your head touch off in the dark, you might actually be able to make out a couloir or where something splits off or something. So turn things on and off for a good idea. It's good to be kind of aware, like being able to listen as well. Because often if you can listen, you can hear where the wind's coming from. But also you can hear like where the wind is blowing over the top of something. If you're trying to find the way down somewhere, if you've got your head like buried in a huge big jacket, it can be disorientating to sort of tell where you're going. So when it comes to like your senses, like your head system, which would include things like your balaclava, your hat, your whatever, your hood on your jacket, whatever, you really want to have a system which is it gives you complete flexibility, so you can turn your head, look up and down with no kind of restriction. You don't want to be like turning your head looking into the side of your jacket hood. You know, you want your hood to be moving around. The worst thing you can get is where you're, every time you look up and down, often your balaclava, if you've got balaclava on, can be like start creeping and creeping. So your balaclava ends up comes down over your eyes, which is extremely annoying when on day five of this happening. So, you know, sometimes you're better having a jacket, like an inner hood and an outer hood. Like your outer hood is your storm hood, which is the hood on your jacket, your shell jacket or your belay jacket. And your inner hood is the hood that would be on, you know, like Rab Vaporize, Buffalo, Tech Light, you know, that kind of thing, where it's a shell, like a breathable Pertex type material, like a lined, like poly thingy. You've got like a brushed polyester kind of material, and you wear that. So that's like covering most of your head, but your face is exposed. But it kind of fits inside underneath your helmet, and it means you can move your head around, and you've still got very good protection on your head because it's windproof. Whereas a balaclava, like even like a power stretch balaclava, is like a really useful piece of kit, but the wind does go right through it, and it does absorb snow. And it'll wet out because it's warm. Where the hood of a soft shell kind of jacket that won't absorb any moisture or very little. So that's often a better way. And then you have to protect your face, and you know, probably like a buff is still probably the best item of kit for that job, unless you're in some like seriously, you know, bad sort of weather, then have like two buffs. So, you know, but it takes like the edge off the wind if the wind's blowing like straight into your face. Like when you're wearing your goggles, make sure nothing is, make sure the goggles are all against your skin. You don't want any material to be going underneath the goggle, because it'll just wick the moisture like can wick the moisture into where the goggles are. So ideally when it comes like really stormy, that's where you need your shell jacket or your belay jacket, because some people won't have a shell, they'll just be having like some sort of soft shell type top. But you want a belay jacket that when you put that on, it covers your helmet, and ideally it's like covering your covering your face and stuff. Don't use lip salve. if you're not, you know, if you got a beard or a mustache or something, that holds a lot more ice, so that can be a pain. So having being clean shaven's like better if you're doing like a long multi-day kind of wintry kind of stuff. Although it does actually protect your face. It protects your face well from wind and from the sun as well, and sort of the cold as well. So the hands, let's think about the hands. So it doesn't matter how good your gloves are if you can't feel your hands. You know, you could be climbing in, you know, the thinnest, most technical, you know, give you the grip of a, you know, of a well-class weightlifter or something. But it doesn't matter if your hands are so cold, you can't feel them. So I've always been a fan of having warm hands in, you know, like I'm still quite a fan of mittens, because nothing is going to be warmer than a mitten, no matter how fancy or expensive your gauntlet kind of gloves are, you know, with fingers and stuff, like ski style black diamond kind of technical gloves. They wear really, really quickly. They're also much more expensive, and you can't really take your hands in and out of them very easily. Where for me, I know it's very old school, I still prefer climbing in like in some sort of shelled mitten where you can take your hands out really, really quickly, like instantly take your hands out, fiddle with something if you have to, then put your hands back in again and away you go. Where when you're trying to fiddle with your big gauntlet gloves that are shoved up somewhere, you know, they're heavy, they're bulky, like mittens don't take up that much space in your, you always want to carry some spare mittens. And so I'm a fan of that kind of style of hand wear, like no matter what kind of climbing. Like I find you can actually get away with a thinner mitten than you can a thinner glove. So even on like more technical climbing, like steep climbing, like ice climbing, I actually find it easier to be, to grip the ice axes with those kind of gloves, unless it's like super mild. And then if it's super mild, you don't really want to be ice climbing anyway. So, a lot of people, it's like, you know, gloves I also tend to find that gloves get trashed really quickly. So I just don't really like, I just think it's kind of wasteful to spend like 160 quid on a pair of gloves that you're either going to drop one of them or just going to wear out like very quickly. Depends what you're doing. You know, sometimes just getting really cheap leather gloves and treating them, you know, like soak them in knitwax and stuff and put, you know, sort of knitwax on them is probably a better for technical climbing. There's a lot of the rubber kind of fisherman gloves. They're cheap. They're really cheap, like 25 quid or something. They're really worth what we're playing around with. And I think often instead of like trying to spend more money to get something better, you might be better just to spend less money and find something that's just as good. So I would recommend that. Hands, yeah. Watch wise, always need a watch. Watch with an alarm. Get something that's like, you know, like it's nice to have a Garmin watch and those kind of things. But I quite like very thick, like really very small watches, like a Casio, like those watches you had when you were a school kid. I quite like those kind of watches because they don't get in the way around your wrist. They're not in. Like often it's quite hard to pull your jacket back to look at your watch if your watch is too big. So a small watch is easier to look at, really. And although the Garmin watches are good in that you can use them to navigate back to somewhere, which is, you know, if you haven't got a GPS, having a GPS watch is kind of handy, but it's always kind of limited. So next you should think about feet. So again, I'm old school. I quite like having warm feet. So again, you could have the most technically advanced boots on the planet, but if your feet are like blocks of ice, then it's not going to do you any good. So I'm still, for winter climbing, I'm still a big fan of either sort of double boots. Like I would generally wear the same boot. If I was going to climb like in Alaska in winter, I'd probably wear the same boots like in Scotland in winter or ice climbing, because, you know, it's all the same thing really, and just get used to climbing in boots which are like probably, you know, a bit, half a kilo too heavy or something. You know, like in Alaska, you know, climbing in like the greater ranges, you could be climbing routes that are just as hard as you were climbing in Scotland or in Norway or somewhere. But like it depends how, like, I don't have great circulation in my feet, so maybe that's why. But some people seem to, you know, some people are now using, you know, like single, you know, layer, you know, sort of boots, like summer alpine boots, like in winter, but with like heated socks. But, you know, I wouldn't want to put my, you know, a multi-day route. Like, I know someone recently who lost all the toes on their foot from, it was definitely one foot that lost all the toes. I think maybe it was both feet lost all the toes from wearing, they were double layer winter boots, but they weren't the warmest you could get. And also they'd fit them too tight. So they'd basically taken their, you know, like cragging style idea of what would be a, you know, winter boot. And they're just taking it on like an Alaskan gnarly, you know, multi-day climb, and they'd end up losing all their toes because of it. So there is, you know, like if you want to wear like your single layer boots, and you feel like they work best for you, because they are easy to climbing, they're much lighter and everything else, then just make sure you've got a good sort of sock system. Like a good thing to look at, like if you want to do like a multi, you know, an extended route in like single leather boots, then you really want to look into like vapor barrier socks, because most of the insulation, like anything that says like Thinsulate, that's just bullshit. That's just marketing bullshit. Thinsulate is basically just shit. Not shit, but it's just nothing to. It's nothing really. So, you know, most of the insulation is going to come from your sock system. So you need a really good like sock system. So on a multi-day route, you'd want to use like some kind of vapor barrier sock. But for like day routes, if you've got like a long approach, what, you know, probably the ideal thing is you walk in and you have a spare set of socks. Maybe you'll have like an inner sock and an outer sock. But you know just change your socks when you get to the climb, and that's probably going to give you much warmer feet really. Now, one thing worth looking into is a mesh insole. I think you probably have to look on some sort of Barmy Army website for these, but they're made out of plastic, and they're probably a little bit thicker than a standard insole, but they're like a multi-angled mesh. What do they call it? A waffle insole. And it's basically made out of hard plastic, which sounds uncomfortable, but what it is that it creates like an actual dead air space underneath your foot. So any moisture that would just be, you know, when often the tops of your socks can feel quite dry. Well, they won't be dry, but they'll look quite dry where the bottoms of your socks, because that's actually just pressing against a plastic, you know, like a non-breathable, you know, sort of insole, is they can be very, very wet. And that's where you're going to get a lot of heat loss is from that area. So these are originally designed, I think, for jungles, because they allowed the moisture in the sock to kind of escape into this insole, into this cavity, and then it would drain out somewhere. You have drain holes in your shoes or something. But then people started using them in like winter, like using them with, you know, Wellington boots and mukluks and those kind of things. So you have this, you just don't get this moisture building up in your socks. So they're very cheap. They're, you know, probably like £5 or something, but they're worth looking at. Good for ski boots. If you've got really sweaty feet, then that's a good thing to look into. But you want like a boot system that you feel confident that you're going to, you know, if it's minus 30 or it's minus 5, if you can, you walk in, you know, can you do, you know, 10 miles in them? Can you 100 meters in them? You know, you want a boot that you feel confident in that can do everything. Or you want several pairs of boots. and just, you know. But you always want to err on the side of caution if you're doing like long routes. So next thing would be probably gaiters. Having a really good set of gaiters is ideal, because they kind of shrink down the area around the bottom of your legs where your crampons are. So the gaiters are protecting you to somewhat your legs from your crampons, which can be, you know, you can get some really nasty crampon injuries. But they're also like stopping things like that are going to snag on your crampons and trip you over and kill you. Some people like the shorty gaiters have become quite kind of popular because like mountain guides, you know, wear them and stuff in the summer. But for winter climbing, you really want, I'd really say you want like proper gaiters. Like if you're doing some Italian overhanging limestone, you know, like route with lots of drilled holes, you're going to go up, then you can just do it in your lycra leggings. You don't need gaiters. But for normal winter climbing, good set of gaiters. It's quite hard these days to buy really good gaiters. They're all because people are obsessed with like lightweight. It's kind of getting harder to get good ones, like really good tough ones. I can't think of any. Like I had some good ones. They were I used to have some really good ones that were MacPack, that were made out of canvas, like the same as the MacPack rucksacks. And then I don't know what happened to those. And then I had some Paramore ones, which had Kevlar in them, which is kind of Kevlar material is expensive, but it is kind of indestructible, so it's ideal. So it's kind of hard to get really good ones. I think at the moment, I'm sure probably Outdoor Research or someone is going to have the best ones. But make sure you get something. Like you can either buy expensive gaiters or destroy a pair of expensive trousers. So gaiters are good. They're good for stomping through the snow. They're good for climbing up the route. They're good for, you know, they give you some, you know, they protect your boots and everything else. And make sure your straps are all, you know, done up and everything's kind of ship shape down there. What else next? I guess you've got your body. Like I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but it's very good. If you're stomping in a long way and you're a sweaty bastard, then it's always worth carrying a separate, you know, spare top, a spare base layer to put on. Of course, I'm always going on about like the Brynja kind of mesh underwear. That's very good for that kind of thing. You don't need to change it because it's can't really hold any moisture, so you tend to feel a lot drier with that kind of thing on. But if you're just wearing normal base layer, like have a base layer you're going to wear walking in, and then just change it when you get there. If you're a woman, like carry a different sports bra or something, change that, like a sport. Like, yeah, that's like a classic place where you're going to just get really chilled by wearing this damp layer, because you're going to be going super fast, it's going to be super hot. Then you can get, a classic thing is, you're going to do like 0.5 gully on Ben Nevis. You're going to race up there like a mad person to get to the route before anybody else. And you're going to end up behind like 20 people, like sweating your ass off. And then you're just going to, you know, even if you put your belay jacket on, if you've got this damp layers underneath, you're going to just like, you know, chill very quickly. So you know, walking in, you always want to set off cold. And you just want to be not too cold. You don't want to be hot, and you probably don't want to be warm. You don't want to be a little bit less than warm when you're walking in. So, you know, a lot of people are going to walk in their, if they've got sort of Gore-Tex shell, they're going to probably wear that on the bottom. So, you know, if you wear like your base layer and your shell over the top of it, and you can vent that off, that's going to work quite well. If you can avoid wearing your shell, that's even better. So that's why shell trousers have long zips, so you can take them on and off. So, you know, if you can get away with it, just walking in without your shell, you know, try and keep your shell layer off until you really need it. Ideally, when you get to the route, then put it on if you got it. You know, like windproof tops are ideal. You know, windproof trousers are good if you got them, like, you know, like a pair of Pertex trousers with full length zips, you wear those instead. And then you know, Pertex kind of top, windproof top over the top of a base layer. You know, you're going to, if you know, you get there, you've got your belay jacket on, you've basically got your approach clothing on, like your active layer, like going quick, your sporty layer, and then you've got a belay jacket on. And when it's time to go, whip off your belay jacket, shove it in your pack, and off you go. And you can adjust the speed. You can adjust your temperature by adjusting your speed if you're fit enough. Like if you're a slow knacker and you're just going to be, you know, sweaty, slow knacker, you probably have to put more clothes on maybe. But, you know, you can speed up, slow down to try and adjust your body temperature. And then when you get there, like it's very important the clothes you wear. Like winter climbing and ice climbing is it can be very, very physical. In some ways it can be more physical than rock climbing, because often rock climbing is like, is it one dimensional? Like it's just a flat something, flat piece of rock with a crack in it or whatever, you're climbing up at it. Where sometimes, you know, winter climbing can often be a lot more engaged, where you're having to sort of do the splits up something, or kind of, you know, ride up some piece of snow like a horse or something, or, you know, digging through stuff. Like it's a lot more, it can be a lot more physical than winter, than summer climbing. But also at the same time, you've got all these clothes on. So A, you want a system where you have got very good flexibility. So that's why a lot of people like gilet kind of, you know, jackets, because they get more flexibility in their arms. And so you want to basically like have a layer that is going to keep you comfortable when you're moving, and it's not restrictive. And that applies to your shell layer. Like that's one reason why the kind of soft shell kind of idea is so good in winter time, because you don't have this big heavy shell jacket, you know, that's kind of can often be a little bit constrictive. So you want like a clothing system that's good for moving, like being gymnastic. So like, you know, like stretchy, you know, stretchy bottoms, stretchy, you know things that aren't too heavy, but things aren't too hot either. And then, you know, then as soon as you stop, you know, the first thing you should do when you stop is put on your belay jacket and, you know, try and retain that. Ideally, it should be like, you always want like a dry heat in your body. So you want a system where you don't have like a wet heat, and you're going to get a wet heat by wearing too many clothes or layers that don't deal with the sweat very well. Or when you, you know, so it's a tricky, it's a not an easy thing to do, but the more you climb, the more you're going to learn how, you're going to know what to, you know, what to put on or to adjust, you know, like, so when I, you know, like some days I can be out pushing this pram. this is all I got reference at the moment. You know, and I might have like a woolly, like a base layer, like a wool base layer top. And then I've got like a swan dry top, which is like another wool. I don't know if you've got a swan dry top is. It's like a, oh, you get, there's like a, it's like a, is it a bush shirt? A ranger shirt it's called. It's like a, it's just like a thick, you know, like itchy wool shirt with like a half zip. So I might have that on. And then I might have like a, what do you call it? A robey, not a robey. What's it called? It's called a, you know, people go swimming and they wear this. It's basically like a buffalo jacket, but it's like really long. It goes past your knees, and it's got a full length zip. It's like, for some reason, it's camouflaged with like pink. It's not mine, it's my wife's. So, you know, I'll put that on, because that's ideal for around here, because it's like having a jacket that goes down past your knees and it's massive. So I've got enough stuff on that I would be, you know, I could probably climb, you know, like K2 in winter in it. And, you know, I've got so many clothes on, but I just adjust my speed pushing this pram. So I can, you know, if I'm getting too hot, I'll just like slow down. You know, it's that kind of ideal, or I could just take something off. But yeah, so the clothing is important. But like, you always want to reverse things though. You want to focus more on your base layer, you know, and then a little bit less on your mid layers, and then even less on your outer layers. Like your base layers is where a lot of the comfort action is going on, and the other layers are kind of less, you know, kind of less important. What else? Gear. Like when you're for winter climbing, you really want, like, for rock climbing, you can get away with just clipping anything on your harness wherever you want, and you generally can, you know, you'll start with it like perfectly racked, and then you'll just bang it anywhere as you're climbing up. But winter climbing, you need to have an absolutely rock solid system, because generally you're going to end up in a position where, you know, you can't get let go of it with your right hand, and your ice screw is on your right hand side, and you can't reach around because your rucksack's in the way, and blah blah blah. So you want a really good system that allows you to get the gear you need when you need it. And your rack can sometimes, you might have 16 ice screws, and other times you might have 16 ice screws and a whole big wall rack of gear, like double sets of nuts, blah blah blah. And you can have winter climbing, you can just have these massive racks of gear. I am still a fan of the bandoliers, having about two bandoliers or two slings. And if the route is not very steep, you don't want bandoliers, because all the gear will just hang down in front of your feet when you're climbing, and you can't see your feet, which is a dangerous and a pain. And if you're on a route that's not super steep, then you don't need that much gear. You can get away with half a set of wires, you know, some slings, whatever. And as it gets more vertical, then you start needing more gear. Probably when it gets overhanging, you need less gear, because it's probably got bolts in it or something. So, you know, you need a way of being able to look down and ideally see the majority of your rack, the rack you might need. So if you've got, say, it's like a chest, like I've often worn a chest harness, a big wall kind of chest harness, because I quite like being able to have all the gear in front of me almost, so I can see where it is. And I've also tried the system where you put your ice screws across the front of your body, a bit like Vietnamese soldier kind of ammo pouches on your chest, like a chest sling. I actually quite like that for ice climbing, because, you know, you're not trying to reach behind you blindly to get this ice screw off. And often you'll, the ice clipper clips are great, the plastic ones, for unclipping them off. But, you know, it's ideally you want to be able to see where they are, because otherwise they're very easy to end up knocking one off, or, you know, the ice screws do seem to get dropped quite easily. So, yes, I quite like those, the tube system. I don't know if Gravel even make that anymore, but I kind of took the Gravel tubes, and I kind of sewed them onto something, so I could attach them across the front of my chest, which is probably looks a bit weird, but I kind of quite liked it. Things have got a lot easier since you now have leashless ice axes. Ice climbing and mixed climbing is way easier now. You don't have to deal with like leashes attached to your wrist and stuff, so it makes it easier to get gear and everything else. But even so, you want you're always developing a system. Maybe you've got two sets of wires, you don't need both sets of wires where you can see them. One set of wires can be around the back. One reason for lifting your gear up high on your body is that there's a bigger chance of you catching your gear on your crampons. So if you're squatting down in some weird position on the route, and it's quite easy for a nut or something to get caught on your crampon, and then you kind of get stuck in this squat position. But you know everything needs to be squared away, everything needs to be tidy, and nothing wants to be hanging down too far. Now the biggest culprit of that is probably your mittens or your prussic loops, which you're going to catch on your crampons when you're in a funny squat position. So a squat position is imagine you're ice climbing and you get a boss of ice. You can often sort of squat on it, and then you can have a little rest or something. But then if you try and stand up and your mitts are now attached to the bungee on your mitts and now attached to your crampons, it can be comical. So if you are carrying mitts on your harness, ideally you want to have all that kind of stuff in a bag, in a little rucksack or something. like a little cragging rucksack or something. Like the leader can have a small rucksack and the second can have, you know, have a slightly bigger rucksack. But if you are going to have it on your harness, your mittens, make sure your mittens are completely sealed when they're on your harness, because it's very easy for them to literally be, you go to get them because your hands are falling off and they're literally full to the top with ice because you left them open. But you also want an attachment point which has them as high as possible on your harness. You don't want to attach them to like a tab on the cuff of the mitt, because then the mitt's going to hang like a foot down below your harness level, which is going to catch on things. You want to have a way of carrying them wet so they're kind of higher up than normal. It might go up and then fold in half, and then that's where you're clipping them on your harness. Now, some people carry like a little belay jacket on a pouch on the back of their harness. So it's it's often worth like looking into, is it better to have like a bum bag or something, or even like a big chalk bag, and try and, you know, that kind of system, something that's actually robust and you can move it around. Because if you've got like a bum bag or a chalk bag kind of system, is then if you're like going to a chimney, you can whip the thing to the side, which has got your mitts and your, you know, that kind of thing. I think there's a lot of, you can overthink these things, but there are probably better ways than having. Yeah, I've seen people climbing and they've got like their jacket in some, you know, like, you know, 10-liter stuff sack, and it's just hanging around down the back of their, you know, it's like hanging around near their knees or something. You know, they're climbing like they've got like their hemorrhoids or something. So it's good to just keep all that sort of tidy around there. In your bag, just always make sure, like, you know, this thing I often say, like, if you're in a hot climb, you always have to finish with water. And the same for winter climbing, is the same applies to food. Like, have some water, but you always need to finish the day with food left over. And ideally you want food that's, you know, so disgusting you're not going to eat it. So, you know, you always want to have like some bars, you know, power bars, something you don't really like that much, like in your bag if you really need it, you know, because you do need to fuel yourself out if, you know, if things get bad. Like, it was it this like a military ration for like winter. So I think in the Second World War it was like 4,000 calories, what a soldier was given. Most of it was probably sugar or something, and I think it's probably, I think I'm not sure what it is actually now, but how much a soldier is should have a day. If you compare that to what a general winter climber would have, a winter climber is going to have a lot less probably. And, you know, so you don't ignore like your hydration, but mainly your food. You know, when you get to the top of the climb, if you've just got one little Snickers bar, that's probably not enough. You know, like if things get difficult and you end up, you know, you think you're going to be down at 10 o'clock at night and you're back at 10 o'clock in the morning. Like these things happen. So you need to be able to fuel yourself to get to the end of the thing. Always invest in the best map case you can find, like probably like an Autoliv one. Make sure it can be easily attached to things. I'd actually make sure it's got like a good attachment system. So if you're taking it out, it can clip into something, because it's very easy for your map to get lost. Make sure you have like all your pacing information, like tape that on the inside of your map case and practice pacing and all that kind of malarkey. Like, don't just try and wing it when you're on the top of Ben Nevis, trying to wing your way down and learning how to map read on, you know, when there's big drops around. So those are like good skills to develop, like on when the weather's bad in the summertime or something, or after work, navigate home. that's like, you don't really carry, like, often when you get to a winter climb, once you take all your gear out, your bag is kind of empty. You know, you'll have your belay jacket in there and your spare mitts and stuff, but often there's not a lot kind of left over. So it's, you know, it's actually a lot easier then, you know, for your to for you know the leader not to have a bag, and you know the second carries both rucksacks. Just put the other rucksack in the other rucksack. So then you need a you want to be like as unencumbered as possible when you're climbing, because especially ice climbing is probably as serious a thing as you're ever going to do. Although you can probably get an ice screw in wherever you are, you know, it's probably it's very hard, you know, if you want them, you know, if it's easy enough that you can place them easily, then you probably don't want them. And if you do want them, it's probably too hard and you can't get them in because you're just hanging on for dear life. So, you know, feeling like very, like you're gymnastic and you're flexible, you can get your, you know, you can do the splits and you get your legs up high, you know, it's very important. And to look down and be able to see your feet, and you know, it's a really, winter climbing is a super serious game. Like recently, I think someone got killed on Ben Nevis recently going through the cornice. Like, I would advise anyone here who's getting into winter climbing is stay away from couloirs and gullies and all that shit. Like, just leave that to skiers. Like, you know, just get onto the, just go climbing. Don't go like wandering up big death chutes of death. You know, like go climbing, go get on the buttresses, get where the belays are, get where there's no cornices. Just avoid, you know, like treat snow like radioactive dog shit, basically. Like, just stay away from that kind of stuff. Like, get on the ice and, you know, and also always be prepared to not go climbing, you know, like, you know, have a look what other things you could do if the weather's too bad, you know, find other, you know, use that day for just go hill walking, you know, go and top rope some crag in your ice tools or whatever, not, as long as you're allowed to, you know, just have some alternative plans of what to do. And, you know, there's a lot of ways to kill yourself. There's a lot of ways to injure yourself. There's a lot of ways to like drag other people in, mountain rescue teams and all those people into your fool kind of dramas. So, you know, it's a serious business. It is great fun though. It's probably one of the most fun things you ever do, because it's kind of great. So, I think my son's probably going to be waking up in a minute now. So I shall leave that there. And I do promise I will try and get back into this whole podcasting malarkey. Like, this child is like, Isla is now two months old. So hopefully I might start returning to having a life again soon. So, until next time, stay safe.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.